chair? Do we have a new vice chair?
You know what?
We do. Welcome to the Commerce Committee, everybody. Welcome back. I think we've all missed each other. I've missed you, Representative Dean. So we have just a handful of bills to hear today, and we've got a bill on the agenda for tomorrow. I'm joined here today by my son, Kai, so I'll introduce Kai. It's not Kai's first time in committee, so he's an old hand. So we do have a quorum. Representative Davids, would you like to move the minutes?
I would like to move the minutes, Madam Chair.
Representative Davids moves the minutes. Is there any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. The first bill we are going to take on the agenda today is House File 1269. Representative Cantrell, welcome to the committee. I will move this bill. I'm going to move that this House File 1269 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means with a recommendation for a hearing in the HHS Finance Division. Representative Cantrell, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to join you today. Today I bring before you House File 1269. It's a bill that that aims to expand the pipeline of folks who can enter and are qualified to enter the mental health workforce, and help to ensure that whether you live in the metro, the suburbs, or outstate Minnesota, you're able to access mental health care, because there will be mental health providers there to help you. More people than ever before are seeking mental health treatment in Minnesota. It is important to expand mental health services to meet this increasing demand, but there's also an urgent need to increase the number of mental health professionals working in the mental health community. Of Minnesota's 11 geographic regions, 9 have been designated by the Minnesota Department of Health as mental health workforce shortage areas. Even in the metro, where there is a more substantial mental health workforce, we know that neighborhoods with high poverty rates are also facing significant workforce shortage. The good news is that we have the tools to develop our mental health workforce in Minnesota. In 2015, the legislature expanded the Rural Loan Forgiveness Program to include mental health professionals. In return for agreeing to practice in a rural community for at least 3 years, a mental health professional, as well as someone in a training or education program, can have a portion of their loans forgiven. These programs work, and they need to be expanded. While it is important to focus on increasing the number of mental health professionals practicing in our state, there are other critical roles to play in providing mental health care as well. For example, in the Native American community, mental health and substance use disorder treatment is more effective when combined with traditional healing services and culturally competent practices. We can't currently bill for these services, but they have a powerful impact for Indigenous Minnesotans living with mental illness. I know that mental health is a top issue for all of us, and there are essential investments that we need to make, that this bill seeks to make, in our mental health workforce in Minnesota. So with that, Madam Chair, I will turn the presentation over to Sue Abderholden.
Ms. Abderholden, welcome to the committee. You can introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. I think there's really just two provisions that are kind of before the Commerce Committee. One is Section 1, which is really making sure that plans cover the treatment provided by a clinical trainee. Currently, under Medicaid and Minnesota Care, we pay for clinical trainees. Many private insurance plans do, but not all. And this would be akin to making sure that a physician resident, is actually providing treatment and getting paid for the care that he or she is providing. And this is the same type of thing. And again, many plans do, but not all. And making sure that we're paying for that care actually allows a lot of mental health clinics to be able to, you know, support and hire them during that time. The second one is on the next page, and this may seem a little bit out of place, but we want to make sure that people are, again, able to access the care that they need. And so this is just saying if there is a denial for mental health treatment, that you actually have a mental health professional who is reviewing that denial. Now, you might say, well, a doctor is a doctor is a doctor, but I guess I would say to you is if you had a cancer treatment that was denied, did you want a psychiatrist reviewing that, or would you actually like to have an oncologist? And we know from many mental health, from many physicians, that they will say they get very little training on mental illness and mental health treatment, especially family physicians. And so it really does matter to us when someone has a very serious illness for that denial to take place, to actually have that reviewed by someone who has knowledge in the field. I don't know if you wanted me to go through the other sections, or those are the two that I think are before the committee today.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. I believe you're correct, and unless members have other questions of you, is there anybody else in the committee in the audience who'd like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, members, any discussion? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't know if this is to Ms. Abderholden or to the bill author. So I noticed on line 5.24, the practicum incentive payments. I know that there are a lot of individuals that are going through their early clinical hours, and sometimes they don't get paid for that time. Would this sort of level the playing field, saying that within a licensed profession, the requirement of training, actually there would be compensation for those individuals? If you could just sort of speak to that.
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Representative, this would be doing that to actually so they don't have to pay for the supervision, which is even on top of the problem that they have now. They don't get paid, and they have to pay for the supervision. So this is a first step to make sure, because a lot of community mental health centers and programs that, frankly, you know, have a very small razor edge in terms of any types of profit. It makes it hard for them to provide that supervision for free. And so this would at least do that piece of it, which I think is a first step.
Representative Dean.
Well, Madam Chair and members, I take issue with any profession that we grant to have a license to practice requiring people that have to go through training or some type of internship or some type of supervision before they're able to achieve their licensure. I mean, I think that that's like really setting up an exploitative system that's really not fair to individuals. And I know that many people that enter certain professions know that that's sort of the thing, but we grant them exclusive abilities to provide certain types of practices and to allow and create a situation for someone either while they're getting their education or shortly after their education that they have to work for free or, as you mentioned, even pay to work to earn those requirements. I think that that's just unconscionable, and I hope that at some point in the future we can start to look at that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you would allow, I'd like to ask a question just slightly outside of our purview because it really does relate to kind of service on the other end and who can receive services. It's in Section 3. I noticed that you added marriage and family therapists and professional clinical counselors to the list, and I kind of know why that would be, but if you could tell the committee why that is and how that expands who can actually use services. So I was on the board of Central Minnesota Mental Health. I stepped away because I'm here so much I just can't make the meetings, but it was something that we did talk about at great length at the Central Minnesota Mental Health Facility and how they're kind of hamstrung, but if you want to talk about it statewide and why that change and how that actually increases the ability of folks to get services.
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Representative. So we have several different types of mental health professionals. So aside from psychiatrists and APRNs, we have licensed clinical social workers, we have psychologists, we have marriage and family therapists, licensed professional clinical counselors. We have not always included the last two as part of our mental health professionals. So for example, Medicare doesn't pay for those two types of mental health professionals who largely, there's more of them in rural Minnesota than in the metro area. So we just wanted to make sure for the training purposes in terms of turning out more people across all of those different types of mental health professionals that they were included. So we've been trying to be diligent over the last couple of years of anywhere we're talking about mental health professionals that we include all of them and not just some of them.
Representative O'Neill, follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just think it's really important because well, for one, there's a lot of those folks being trained in Minnesota. There's quite a few programs that do train marriage and family therapists and professional clinical counselors at different levels. There's a couple different levels. And it seems a little bit, there's a disconnect because you're training all these folks to be mental health professionals and then you're hamstringing them on the other side because of billing and such. So I'm just glad to see this in the bill. And I think that it really does broaden those that can actually do the services and get trained and do the service. So I just am glad to see this in the bill. And it's a, particularly in greater Minnesota, it's a real problem. So I'm just glad to see it there, and I just wanted to get that on the record.
Thanks, Representative O'Neill. Additional discussion, members? Representative Cantrell, it looks like you have the final word.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1269 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means with a recommendation for a re-referral to Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The motion prevails, and you are on your way.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd like to move House File 2538, and I'm not entirely positive where this Peace in the Valley bill goes.
To Ways and Means with a recommendation for Jobs and Economic Development Finance.
I hear
that's a great committee.
One more in my particular. If there's freshmen on the committee, this is the bill I signed.
Yeah,
that's what I go with too. And frankly, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I did not see this amendment until not hours ago, but maybe a day and a half ago. And as the chair understands, I was recovering from a joyful experience with a moment of illness. So I'm going to move my A1 amendment, and then I'm going to call a friend down to explain it. As I read it, it seemed like a pretty simple amendment. So, but there was something from the doctor that helped out there.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. And the chair does understand and sympathize. So Representative Mahoney moves the A1 amendment. It is, as he explained, a substantial amendment. So we will invite the commissioner and Mr. Brickwitty down to explain the amendment before we take action. Thank you. Welcome back to the committee, Commissioner.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for considering the bill this afternoon. I'm Steve Kelly. I am the commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Appreciate the opportunity to do a brief introduction as to why there is a substantial unclaimed property policy bill traveling in the governor's budget recommendation for the Commerce Department. The reason is simple, even if the bill language is not. Updating Minnesota's unclaimed property law will require changes to how the Commerce Department administers the unclaimed property program. The governor's budget contains funding for additional staff to increase the number of claims the department can process for consumers, account for modern and specialized financial products, and improve our partnerships with businesses to make the process of reporting unclaimed property to the state easier. The policy changes will also increase both the amount of property turned over to the state in compliance with state law and the amount of property returned to Minnesotans. The current unclaimed property law was enacted in 1969 and has been revised only modestly since then. The law is out of date, does not reflect 21st century business practices or financial instruments, and makes it harder for Minnesotans to claim their property and Minnesota businesses to comply with the law. Over the long term, failure to modernize Minnesota's unclaimed property laws will erode the Commerce Department's ability to administer the unclaimed property program. These statutory changes that are proposed will improve our ability to return property to its rightful owners wherever they live or work. It will also improve the equitable treatment of Minnesota businesses by clarifying legal requirements for turning abandoned property over to the state so it can be returned to consumers. I will turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Peter Brickwitty to answer more in-depth questions members may have about the bill.
Mr. Brickwitty, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner at the Commerce Department. My thanks to you and to Representative Mahoney for bringing this forward. So, members, the A1 amendment contains the language from the governor's budget proposal, the policy language related to unclaimed property. The A2 amendment corrects a drafting error that was present in the governor's budget language. So that's why we have the A2 amending the A1. But the A1 language is the policy language, copy and paste, from the governor's budget related to unclaimed property. Madam Chair, I'm happy to do whichever you prefer. I can walk through kind of the in broad strokes what's in the amendment, or if you want me to adopt it, and then I can speak afterwards, whichever one you'd like.
Mr. Brickwitty, since it is a substantial amendment, I think it would be helpful to the committee if we got to walk through
sure.
the amendment.
So Madam Chair, this language was developed by the department and was introduced this year for the first time. It draws from the Uniform Law Commission's most recent Unclaimed Property Uniform Act. It also sources material from the state of Illinois' 2018 revisions to that state's unclaimed property law, which was a more wholesale, comprehensive revision of their entire chapter, and also settlement agreements that Commerce has entered into related to unclaimed property. There are four kind of big buckets of content in the amendment. The first is addressing the legal status of how the state handles paying claims on properties that are reported to the state as interest earning. That language, I believe, is on page 29 of the A1 amendment. And that language would set a uniform standard for how the state complies with the state Supreme Court decision that was issued last year. The second kind of big bucket of content is in Article 1 of the bill. It updates definitions. As Commissioner Kelly was indicating, this area of law was most recently updated before the internet existed and before most modern financial products that we use today and the ways that we interact with our financial institutions and other businesses online was contemplated. And so we are adding new and amending some existing definitions to reflect those modern financial products and processes that are in use today. The third kind of big area of the bill is dealing with what we call holder compliance, and it modernizes the due diligence relationship between companies and customers to prevent property, in our view, from being inappropriately turned over to the state or inappropriately labeled as abandoned when it is not, in fact, abandoned and then sent to the state unnecessarily. I think you'll hear from some of the other testifiers on some of that language as well. And then the fourth big bucket is holder reporting, clarifying the requirements and processes for how companies turn property over to the state. Madam Chair, in our view, and this is a national issue, not specific to Minnesota, but holder compliance with unclaimed property laws is generally quite poor, and we think in our case some of that is due in large part to the fact that our existing law is not clear in many cases on what types of property should be reported to the state and when. And so we'd like to improve that process so it works better for businesses who do, in fact, have unclaimed property that needs to come over to the state. As Commissioner Kelly mentioned, this policy language is traveling in the governor's budget because it will increase the amount of property both that is turned over to the state and the amount of property that the state is able to return to consumers. And it represents our kind of first step towards bringing the Minnesota unclaimed property law into the 21st century. It is not a finished product. And we're going to continue to work with the stakeholder community this year and in the future on a wholesale revision of our law. Madam Chair, I'd add at this point, too, that we've been meeting on an individual basis with stakeholders, and we're hoping to convene a large group meeting to go through the bill in more detail. I'd like to thank the life insurers, the Credit Union Network, the Bankers Association, the Safe Bar Association, and the Minnesota-based representatives of the Uniform Law Commission, all of whom have given us direct feedback on the language that you have before you in the A1 amendment. And our commitment to those groups and to you, members, is that we'll move forward with consensus language. The Minnesota unclaimed property law needs to work for consumers. It needs to work for the businesses that have unclaimed property and have those Minnesotans as customers, and it needs to work for the department as the administrator of the program. We do want to get the changes to the law done correctly. We don't want to do them quickly and get them wrong. So, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer questions on specific areas of the language if members have questions.
Questions for Mr. Brickwitty at this time? Representative Elkins, Representative Davids.
Okay. Go ahead. Madam Chair, I'm hearing that this bill will have additional stops so that if there are suggestions for changes along the way, you're still open to amendments during the process.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Actually, I'll take that one.
Representative
Yes, it's coming eventually to my committee, and I suspect to my omnibus bill, more likely than not. So, and I have instructed all the parties that I do not want to have a fight on the floor on something I'm not entirely sure of and only have 2 or 3 weeks to learn. So they have a couple of weeks to come to consensus, and as one of the representatives at the table here likes to say, peace in the valley, so that I don't get any guff on the House floor.
Is that a trademark term, Representative? Are we allowed to use it? Or?
You know, we're the legislature. We get to do whatever we want.
Almost.
So long as
that's a different debate,
votes.
Representative. Thank you for that answer. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a lot of other questions here as we go on, but why are we doing this now when the stakeholders haven't, maybe to Mr. Brickwitty, when the stakeholders haven't sat down yet and talked about this? It seems a little premature to be doing this. I think it should be laid over, and I don't want to mess up the fine bill 2538 that Chair Mahoney has, but we're doing this just backwards. We're, you know, let's pass it so we can find out what's in it. That didn't work so well in a bill I can think of previously. So I don't know that it's ready here, but just a couple quick questions. How many staff would be hired to take people's money earlier than they would now?
Representative Davids, I think that that's going to be answered in the Jobs Committee, because this isn't a Finance Committee, and we don't have the fiscal analysis on the bill.
That is correct. And we won't be taking people's money. We won't be taking people's money. We'll be trying to find people who have money that they think has likely been abandoned.
Well,
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the policy part here, maybe Ms. Pampu can help out here. On page 9, the last line, 3 years after the following dates, what's current law? It says 3 years. Is current law 4 years?
Ms. Pampu. Okay. We have a pass. Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair and Representative Davids, specific to your question on and that particular reference on tax-deferred retirement accounts, I think there is a change in the Uniform Act there from current law, and I think one of the areas that we very much want to clean up generally in working with stakeholders to make sure we get right is related to the achievement or the prevention of retirement accounts being turned over to the state inappropriately. The state is not interested in receiving as unclaimed property individuals' retirement accounts when they should not be turned over to the state. There are significant tax consequences to consumers if it comes to the state and then needs to be returned to them. And so there are a lot of interlocking provisions in the bill that expand the ways that consumers are able to indicate to their holder that they are still there and they still are maintaining contact with their accounts to prevent property from being escheated to the state, particularly when it comes to retirement accounts.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and to Assistant Commissioner Brickwitty. In the amendment here, how many areas are there where there is less time to try and find the property owner than there is now?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair and Representative Davids, let me just clarify so I understand your question correctly. Do you mean less time for the holder or for to maintain a relationship or try to make sure that they have contact with the property owner when the property is in their possession? Or are you asking how much time that the state would have to return property to consumers once it comes to the state?
Well,
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I'm looking at is what areas are there where, let's say, you had 5 years, now you have four, or you had 4 years, now you got three. Are any of those timelines being moved up, shortening the time where they have to do it?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And Madam Chair, excuse me. Yes, Representative Davids. In some of the securities-related areas, and I think you'll hear from Ms. Rowan on those, and we've been in dialogue with them and understand the life insurance industry in particular is significant concern about that, and we'll continue to work with them to see if we can write a language or if we need to set that area aside for this year.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Mr. Brickwitty. Additional member discussion at this time? Okay, so we have amendment. We have the amendment before us, and
Madam Chair, we might want to amend the amendment.
As amended.
It's the A2 is an amendment to the amendment?
Yes.
Okay, so Representative Mahoney moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The A1 amendment is before us. Any further discussion at this time? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted, and the bill is in the shape that the author wants. And at this time, we can take additional public testimony. Ms. Rowan. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. I've often heard the department describe the unclaimed property division as sort of the state's lost and found. But I think it's really important that people understand that we're not talking about a box of mixed-match mittens outside the principal's office. We're talking about proceeds from life insurance policies that can be in the tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. We're talking about people's retirement accounts. We're talking about their bank accounts. We're talking about annuity proceeds. And so when the state presumes that those assets are abandoned and takes them, it needs to be done right. And as the department acknowledged, it's not there yet. It's not even close. From our perspective, the problem is that the department chose to use a new Illinois law as its starting point to draft this bill. And I can just tell you, having grown up in Chicago, you should never use an Illinois model as an example of fiscal responsibility, ever. But the problem with that bill was it was snuck in the middle of the night. It wasn't even heard in committee. And where they should have started is with the Uniform Law Commission's model law. And that's what our current law is based on. That was vetted over a period of years with all the experts and the stakeholders at the table. And so what the Illinois law and the department's proposal do is they speed up escheatment to the state of life insurance, annuities, retirement accounts, and the other items that we mentioned. So it speeds up the time frame from when making them presumed abandoned sooner and turned over to the state. But it does so in a way that doesn't adequately protect consumers. And I'll just give you a few examples. I mean, I'm an insurance nerd anyway. I could actually go on all day. But any of you who want to talk about it more, see, Representative Dean's like, stop. The first example I'll provide is with respect to life insurance. So under Minnesota law, life insurers are required to pay interest from the day someone dies to the day we pay the claim. But that stops when we turn the proceeds over to the state. So if we're turning things over faster, consumers are being deprived of interest that they would have earned had we held onto it longer, as we would under current law or under the model law. Another example is if you talk about money in an annuity and the person dies, the IRS rules say that money can sit in the annuity for 5 years and you don't have to do anything. It can just sit there for 5 years. But under the department's proposal, what can happen is that the annuity can be presumed 3 years after death of the owner, and if the insured can't find the beneficiary, the money's going to the state 2 years earlier than it would have. And so those are just two examples that we're very concerned about. So we appreciate the sentiment expressed by Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner Brickwitty, that he wants to get it right and not fast. We appreciate the sentiments of the author that he doesn't really want to dig into this and have a food fight on it, although I think it would be...
It's fun now.
fun. So we will continue to work with the department, but we have some really significant concerns about moving forward with this in the bill in its form right now. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rowan. Any questions for Ms. Rowan? Seeing none. Next up, thank you for your testimony. Next up is Tess Rice.
Hello.
Welcome to the committee. You can introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tess Rice. I'm General Counsel for the Minnesota Bankers Association. The MBA is a trade association that represents 96% of the banks in Minnesota, from the largest to the very smallest. We appreciate the opportunity to comment on this today. Banks play a major role, of course, in unclaimed property process. We're holding a lot of money for people. So it's really important to our members that we come up with a final product here that works well for them and for their customers. Our members have raised numerous issues with the bill as it is. We've provided a 6-page letter to the department describing many of those issues, and we have met with Assistant Commissioner Brick Witte, and he's assured us that he will work with us on that. So we look forward to working with the department and other stakeholders on it to deal with our issues on this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I can answer any questions if you have any about how this impacts bank customers.
Ms. Rice, I think we have a question from Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, could you copy me on that 6-page letter?
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, yes, absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to see that. And
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And looking through the bill, it sets up people can go to find money. So there will be non-state employees or non-federal employees would be paid a commission to find money. So what you would potentially have here is non-government employees looking through bank records to try and find money. Now that's a little bit frightening to me that would be allowed in this bill, that you could have not bank examiners, not folks from the Department of Commerce that do a wonderful, wonderful job, but just folks. I mean, people like me and Representative Dean. I mean, now that doesn't scare you. You don't scare easy. So I don't know what your thoughts are on that to the witness, Madam Chair.
Ms. Rice.
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, that is our major concern. Our overriding concern is having non-commerce employees coming into our banks and going through our customers' records. The Commerce Department has assured us that they already have that ability to do that, so I've asked them to just show me where that's at because I don't know where it is. But they've told us that they could have done that already if they wanted to, and they haven't wanted to go into a bank and do this with a third party. But we'd sure like to see it in writing that it would only be bank examiners coming in.
Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair, I can see clearly that if the department can already do that, there will be an amendment on the floor to say that they can't do that.
Representative Davids, I think the department would like to comment as well if we can get some more information from them.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and Representative Davids, far be it for me to discredit the firm of Davids and Dean and your work performance, but Representative Davids, I think you're referring to the department, the language in the bill allowing the use of third-party auditors. And so I think very specifically, and we discussed it yesterday with the Bankers Association, we also had a conversation last week with the Credit Union Network who raised similar concerns. Particularly with regard to state chartered financial institutions, the department also, as you know, is the regulator of those institutions. And so we utilize our bank and credit union examiners to, when they are doing their regularly scheduled bank or credit union examinations, they have modules in their processes to check for unclaimed property compliance. So we feel like, particularly in Minnesota, and we're somewhat unique as an unclaimed property administrator because predominantly these programs are housed in either state treasury offices or other non-sort of insurance or financial institutions regulators. But we have that here in Minnesota. So we rely on our bank and credit union examiners to examine for unclaimed property compliance to the extent that we were to identify a problem with unclaimed property compliance, the Financial Institutions Division could refer that information to the Unclaimed Property Unit. The Unclaimed Property Unit could then potentially go in and do unclaimed property-related examination or audit. But I think before we would get there, it would go through the normal examination process for that bank or credit unit. And I would also add that I think we would see something similar from our federal regulatory partners when it comes to federally chartered financial institutions as well, too. So I know that this is an area of concern for the banks and credit unions, and we're happy to continue to work with them on it, but I want to make sure that it's clear to the committee that we have trained Commerce Department state employees who are doing bank and credit union examinations now, which include examining and looking at compliance, and it would only be to the extent that we would identify through that process an issue that we would turn something over to the unclaimed property unit specifically.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And to Assistant Commissioner Brickwitte, I'm pretty touchy on some of the stuff. The regulators in the Commerce Department that regulate banks and insurance companies are second to none. They're second to none. They do a great job. In fact, Minnesota is one of the toughest states there is, and I think that's good because I don't want to buy insurance from Shifting Sands Mutual or somebody else. And the Department of Commerce makes sure that there are no Shifting Sands Mutuals. But the issue of folks that are not in the Commerce Department going into a bank frightens me, and we'll talk more about that offline.
And Madam Chair, Representative Davids, appreciate your words, as I'm sure do our staff. And I would note that to the extent that the department is utilizing a third-party auditor to do an examination of any entity, that organization would have to go through the state procurement process, same as any vendor that the department or any other state agency would use. And from my view, they are our agents if we are employing them, and so they would be held to the same standard that state employees would be as well. But understand your concern, happy to work with you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Mr. Brookwitty, additional member questions? Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've spent most of the last decade in the healthcare industry, and so I've gained some familiarity with the Social Security Death Master file. And the bill seems to contemplate very heavy reliance on the contents of that file, which are known to be incomplete. And every once in a while, somebody will find themselves on it who isn't really dead, and it's very, very difficult once you're on it to get off of it. And even to the logic is very rigidly prescribed. And I would, being in a data scientist, I think that you would want to do this in a way that you would be open to the use of improved matching technology if somebody could find a better way to do this. So I don't know that it's wise to be quite as detailed and prescriptive as the bill is right now. Plus, I'll just give you an example. I was just refreshing my recollections of what the Death Master is and what it contains, and in the course of my exploration discovered that one of the primary consumers of the Death Master file is genealogical services. The value add from a genealogical service that occurred to me might be very valuable to a life insurance company, for example, in determining or a bank in terms of determining who the heirs of the dead person might be, and that kind of information might also be very valuable to the department or our bank or insurance company in terms of identifying the proper beneficiary of a financial account. So I just raised that I think that maybe we're being too prescriptive in the way that particular data source is being used.
Madam Chair,
comments, Mr. Brookwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, thank you for that for those comments. The language surrounding the Death Master file usage and whom would be using it is a subject of ongoing discussions with the life insurers, and I think you are right that the quality of the data and the Death Master file is always a bit of a challenge. Mm-hmm. I think two points that we're going to continue the discussions with the life insurers that I think are really important to get right. To your question about the prescriptive nature, this language, this area, I think beginning on page 16 and moving into page 17, and I was hoping to, Madam Chair, get through the entire hearing without having to say the words fuzzy match, but we use that a lot of times. It comes, I think, from the NCOIL, the National Conference of Insurance Legislators Model Act, and it was intended to provide some direction to holders about what to do in the event that you don't get a 100% match. And so this is model language that we were hoping to employ there. But I think the point is very well taken, because it's much more likely than not that you would get a quote-unquote fuzzy match than a 100% accurate match. And I think we've also discussed with life insurers whether or not the department should be proactively using the Death Master file, or if the holder should be using it, and what do you do in circumstances where you may have something the Death Master file that would indicate that someone may be dead. Does that cause the insurance company or the holder to then initiate an investigation, or is that does being on the Death Master file presume that you are in fact dead? And to your point, I think there's a lot of question about the overall accuracy of that file, which is updated on a periodic basis. And that is, I think, one of the key questions that we want to make sure we get correct with the life insurance industry in particular, but make sure that we have correct for all holders, because if we get that wrong, it will lead to confusion, and confusion will lead to less property being with the correct owner or with the correct heir over time.
Representative Elkins, follow-up.
The depiction of the fuzzy logic in here is basically kind of decision tree logic, and that might not be the best way to do it.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of things. Number one, Representative Mahoney, thank you. Thank you for your willingness to work on this, because this one's got a lot of bees buzzing around it, I think, adoption in the state of Minnesota. Pardon me? Well, that's an interesting metaphor. The thing that I'm concerned about is not, number one, that we shouldn't be updating the law. The thing I'm concerned about is that when we use the word model language, that this is at the department's own admission, we're not necessarily using the standard model that industry experts have worked on in many different states to try to come up with over a long period of time. We're using the Illinois model and looking to try to adopt that in the state of Minnesota. Whenever possible, I think it's important in our ever-growing economy, where we are interconnected with other states and interconnected with other economies, that we try to put a standardization of rules and a standardization of processes in place whenever possible. One of the other things that I'm concerned about is many of the different providers of financial services in the state of Minnesota have looked at current statute and creating their contracts and their life insurance policies, annuity policies, et cetera. And there could be some conflict in the contract language based on some of the statutory updates that are being proposed with carving back the amount of time that the companies have with the ability to be able to search out the policy owner, the contract holder, whoever the case may be. And I'll just give you a quick example on this. In a life insurance policy that's classified as a permanent policy, it states there's a provision in there that's called the reinstatement provision. And simply what the reinstatement provision says is if an insured stops making their premiums, the company could be sending out the notices, the notices could be either having back returned to sender because that individual has moved, or they just say, you know what, I don't want this policy anymore. Eventually the insurance company will cancel me for non-payment of premiums. And so they ditch those notices. The insurance company may not know that that person is still alive. And under the reinstatement provision, after a period of time lapses, that moves from a permanent policy to an extended term policy. I have concerns that might have been the intentions of the individual. They just didn't formalize that with the insurance company. And I get concerned that this could then escheat to the state of Minnesota, when that is one of the things that the policy owner had hoped to be able to accomplish under the policy without actually taking formal steps, because it is a policy provision. And so, again, Representative Mahoney, I do appreciate your willingness to take a look at this. I think that we do need to do some updates in our statutes as it relates to unclaimed properties, but I also think it's very important that we take a slow and prudent step to doing this. A little bit of a side note, if we want to implement the entire spirit and breath of what Illinois did, I believe that they used the proceeds from this to fund their unfunded pensions or underfunded pensions in the state of Illinois. And I suspect that Chair Murphy would be very happy to hear that, that's an option that might be available in the state of Minnesota as well to help with future unfunded liabilities, since she has been a champion of trying to get a standing line item in all budgets that would deal with pensions. So maybe not necessarily a question, Madam Chair, but a few comments and some things to reflect on as we move forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Any comment, Mr. Brickwitty?
No, Madam Chair, I can appreciate that we have had much stronger leadership on pension issues than the state of Illinois has had.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have another question about PATH, because there's two complete articles about data practices and judicial review, which needs to go to the Judiciary Civil Law Committee. I'm just wondering if that's, since this is literally a massive amendment of 37 pages of brand new language and not a bill, I don't know if that's been a consideration, but it really should go to Judiciary. It's 4 pages of data practices.
Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, it is not something that I have considered. I can certainly take a look at it, but I think at this late date, as we try to the joy of being one of the first bills probably out of the chute means I have to get my bill together sooner than maybe I wanted to in the first place. But I'll certainly take a look at it. And at this particular point, I don't know if I'm going to try and get it to data practices and judiciary.
Well, Madam Chair, that's
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, that's incredibly problematic. This is four pages of brand new language. It's an entire new article about data practices. It's Article 10 is dealing with judicial review. We don't have expertise here, nor does the Jobs Committee have expertise in those areas. And I'm the only one at the table right now on that committee because I see Representative Blush is not here, but the chair of the committee. I really think this needs to go. There's a lot of new language here, and I think it's really important, particularly with the conversation that Chair David's, Representative David's had about third parties coming in and reviewing data. They need to be underneath Chapter 13 requirements, and that's the purview of the Judicial Civil Law Committee. It absolutely has to go there. Talking about third party, so non-state employees going in and reviewing all that data, you need to absolutely make sure that they are within the Chapter 13 responsibilities. And I am the only one on this committee that's also on judiciary and civil law, and I'm not going to accept that responsibility. It needs to go there.
I believe Representative Carlson is on that committee as well. I want to give you credit.
Yeah, but I'm no expert, so.
Okay. Noted. Thank you, Representative O'Neill, and I think the author has heard the request and will take that under advisement. Additional member questions at this time? Seeing none, is there anybody else in the audience who'd like to testify for or against this bill? Welcome to the committee. You can pull up a chair there. Or welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hi, my name is Kim Lowe, and I'm one of the Uniform Law Commissioners here in the state of Minnesota. There's been a lot of references to Model Acts and the Uniform Act and the Act in Illinois. We have four appointed Uniform Law Commissioners in the state of Minnesota. As a contingency, we have 10. Three of our commissioners worked on the revised Uniform Unclaimed Property Act. We were asked by the department to take a look at the proposed language. We provided comments. We indicated that it really doesn't meet, it isn't the Uniform Act. It has a few things that were pulled from the Uniform Act, but it certainly doesn't have the some of the protections, some of the other items that have been brought up today that the Uniform Act took 4 to 5 years of many stakeholders looking at, that many of the questions that have been brought up and have been addressed are covered in the Uniform Act. And so from the perspective of the Uniform Law Commissioners here in the state of Minnesota, we think that's a better place to start, and that the process should be starting from that and falling in what the department would like to see and what is probably good for the citizens of the state of Minnesota. And so we wanted to make sure that as all of these uniform models were sort of bandied about, that it was clear that this does not sort of follow or track the Uniform Act, and nor does the Illinois Act, even though it calls itself the Uniform Act. And Uniform Law Commissioners oppose the Illinois Act as well.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Seeing none. Representative Mahoney.
Final words. What I will do is I will be talking to the chair of the committees that Representative O'Neill has spoken to. I want to move this forward and keep the pressure on all the participants in this particular bill so that we can move this through this year. I think the state has not gotten enough money back to people that have lost property. I would appreciate your vote.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney, and thanks for your dedication to working on getting to the traditional peace in the valley on these bills. So with that, Representative Mahoney renews his motion to re-refer House File 2538 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a recommendation for a hearing in Jobs and Economic Development Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no.
No.
Motion prevails, and you are on your way.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further business in front of our committee today, we are adjourned.
Yeah.